Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the latest in our series of real estate lectures. We had a successful series in the last academic year, and this is the second of three this term. And for this one, we welcome again, as we did for one of the lectures last year, at the University of Wisconsin on the video link. And we're all pleased to see you here. We have noted the result in your election, and particularly in the state of Wisconsin, but we're not planning to hold it against you this evening. Now, this evening, we have Harry Platt, who is CEO of the Workspace Group. Harry was in local government for many years in Greenwich and in Harlow, where he was chief executive, but has been chief executive officer of the Workspace Group since 1991. And the title is An Alternative Business Strategy for an Alternative Property Company. The word alternative has many meanings. I usually think it means without a tie, but actually Harry has got a tie on this evening. The Workspace Group define themselves as providers of flexible offices, studios, workshops, small unit, light industrial and storage space throughout London and the southeast, and they very much see themselves as part of the urban regeneration initiative in this region, but that doesn't mean that they're not successful. Indeed, they have been very successful financially. So without more ado, I'll hand you over to Harry Platt, and then after he's spoken, we will do the difficult exercise of taking questions from both here and in Wisconsin. But we just about managed it last time, so I'm sure we'll succeed. Do you want to say anything else now, Paul? Right. Over to you.
Thanks, Paul. And thanks, Howard. And I'm delighted to be invited here to give you a short talk tonight, and to with our international colleagues as well. There's two things I've been given for this talk. One is yourselves, the audience here, and also across the Atlantic, you know, an academic, intellectual, international audience. And I'm not used to that because I'm used to talking to customers or investors. So if I fall into that today, that's really what I'm treating you as, customers or investors. The second thing I've been given is the title. I didn't choose that. I suppose why I've been given this title, and why I've been invited to give a talk tonight, is because we have been reasonably successful. So if you look at our 10-year record, the last time we raised equity was in 1994, and since that time our shareholders have had a six-fold increase in their capital. We've also had tremendous dividends and earnings through that period. The size of the company has grown, as you can see there, so we now have over 100 estates. That's actually the financial performance of the business, but if you look at the underlying property performance that we have, as you can see in this chart, we compare our performance with the IPD measure. The IPD is the Investment Property Data Bank. It's all of the UK commercial property, so it's about a billion or whatever properties in there. As you can see, on a 5 or a 10-year basis, on the right side, we're in the top percentile in terms of our performance. That means we're in the top 1, 2, or 3 funds. And you can see the consistency of the returns that we've given over time as well. Very robust returns. If you look at our recent performance, yeah, we were only 11th last year, but actually that's more a reflection of what's happening in the rest of the property sector, because retail has performed very well in the last 2 or 3 years. And as you know, in the real estate sector, retail performs in cycles. So it's in that little thing. But it will go down, but ours is robust and long-term. The other thing about the graph, by the way, is that in which sector do you place us? IPD have very great difficulties on this, because are we an industrial company or an office company or whatever? Very difficult. We're workspace. I'll tell you more about that in a minute. So, I was given this title, but really what I call ourselves, we are a property-based business. I don't like being called a property company. And the reason for that is we do everything the opposite of the property sector. Our tenants are customers. We're producers. We're customers. We're not interested in large businesses with good covenants. We're interested in the whole range of small businesses. We're not dealing with prime properties, you know, your West End, your city, things like that. We deal in so-called secondary and tertiary property, but properties that are prime for our customers. We don't give in long-term leases. What our leases are, it's a three-year lease, protected by the Landlord and Tenant Act, but with the customer's right to break at 3 months' notice. Marginal rents and average rents, what I'm talking about there is we're not dealing with traditional valuation means about how we actually conduct and husband our particular stock. And we're not asset collectors or creators, if you like, in one sense. What we are, we're creating a long-term business tied into the London economy. And I'll come back to this later on. So what am I going to do in my little talk to you tonight? There's two parts of the presentation. First part, I'm just going to tell you a flavour of our business, because you need to get a flavour of it. Then I'm going to talk about some of the factors that underpin our business. And I hope you take away three things tonight. One is some idea of what we're about, what Workspace's strategy is about. Two, that you take away some idea of what small businesses, the energy, dynamism, and how it actually, you know, small businesses work and the sector. And the third is really about small businesses in the London economy. So I hope you take those things away. But first of all, let's go through the background to the business. The business was set up in 1987 by our first chairman, Alan Porter, who was the ex-chief executive of the Water Industry Pension Fund. And what he did, he said to a group of institutions, when buying out this group of secondary properties from the residuary body of the GLC, he said, look, if you provide a small amount of equity and some long-term debt, we're going to buy these properties that you wouldn't dream of buying. These are all secondary, tertiary properties. We're going to let them to small businesses who you wouldn't dream of letting these businesses to. You know? And we're going to give them short-term leases. They can actually leave at 3 months' notice. But what we're going to do is create a resilient income stream by putting in expert management on how we work this. And it stands about how he did that. It's still, to this day, the foundations of the business. If you look at the growth of the business, the last time we raised equity was in 1993, and the rest of the time we've grown by this debt-driven organic growth. So what is the simple business model? And this slide is the slide we present to investors at every single presentation. And it's a very, very simple business that we've got. It's all about providing space to SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises. And by that I mean enterprises that have between 2 and 15 people. They probably have a turnover, 100,000 to no more than £1 million, tend to be owner-managed. This kind of sector, that's the sector we're in. And what we do, we buy properties that will let long-term to that sector under any economic climate. We focus on the income yield that we get on those properties, and we drive the income yield forward. We then get an improvement in our asset values, even without any yield shift. So the capital growth is there without yield shift. But the other part of the business is, because we're working in areas of change, because we're buying off low capital values for SMEs in so-called areas of regeneration, whatever, inevitably, what will happen over time on some of our properties is there will be alternative use, change of use, or intensification, just with the city. That will occur. Now, as we increase the scale of this portfolio, and because we're focused on London South East, we're able to spread the overheads over a wider base, and our brand steadily becomes more important. It becomes more important in terms of our customers, in terms of the gatekeepers, in terms of local authorities and that. And finally, the right financial platform is simply about the equity-debt balance, and we work on 50% equity, 50% debt, 100% gearing. So if you look at it, at the beginning of the 1990s, we may have bought properties off an income yield of, say, 10 or 11%, taking the income yield up to about 14% or so, putting a mixture of equity and debt in place, 50-50, getting a 20% return on our equity on the income alone. Today, of course, it's not working that way, but we're still getting high double-digit returns on the income alone. That's the base of the business. So where are we now as a company? This gives you a simple summary. The product that I've already said is this lease that we provide, a lease where our customers can break at 3 months' notice. So we've now got 3,800 customers providing an income stream of 40-odd million, which conceptually, I suppose, could go in 3 months. But as I'm going to show later on, it's actually a resilient, long-term income stream. We do everything in-house. Management is all internalized. We don't want to use agents, valuers, and things like that. It's everything is done so in terms of debt collection, lettings, and things like that. And if you were a customer, you came into our offices tomorrow morning, you'd see someone like Sean, and you'd negotiate with Sean. Sean left school about 3 years ago. You'd be able to move in the afternoon into your. If you said, "I want to use a lawyer," we said, fine. You go away and use a lawyer, but you can't move in today, obviously. Also, you double your upfront costs as a business because you'd pay the lawyer. And by the way, you still negotiate with Sean. And you know, you may get the word reasonably in the lease. Okay? The best rev what Sean will say to you if you're going to use a lawyer, say, well, yeah, do use a lawyer, but you know, why don't you talk to some of our other customers? Why don't you go see them? Ask them about it. So it's all internalized. We have clear core values for this business as well. One is to be a good landlord. One is to give the best deal possible to our customers. That's not about being cheapest, it's being the best deal. And that's about the price, the standard of service, and it's also about the nature of the lease. We aim in London to be the first point of contact for any new or small business seeking to relocate within London. It's an aspiration. And finally, we aim to be a good employer. And that's fundamental because we're talking about customer service. Final thing on the slide, this is a huge marketplace. We are the leading provider of this kind of space for small businesses in London with 3,800 customers. Yet there are 330,000 small businesses in London. So we just have over 1% of the market, but we are by far the leader. This shows you where our portfolio is. Our portfolio is worth about, say, 650 million. The nearest competitors would only have a portfolio of, say, 50 or 60 million. Competitors in our sector. So we dominate this marketplace. We monitor targets for a long period of time. So today we're monitoring 200 properties in London which are worth about 500 million. Whenever you look at our acquisitions each year in the annual report accounts, half of them will have monitored for up to 10 years. What about the areas? If you look at that map, well, what's quite interesting about the density of it, 50% of the portfolio, 50%, whoops, is within 5 miles of here. Nearly 90% is within the M25. What about the capital values? Capital values are around about 110, 115 pounds a square foot. On a comparative basis, they're very low. And we only buy on the basis of existing use for new and small businesses, not with any prospects for change of use. Well, the other side of it is about what are the rents? The rents are about £8.50, £8.60 average per square foot. So the average customer in 1,000 square feet in London is paying less than £10,000 a year, less than £200 a week. And our basic stance is, if you as a business can't afford that kind of rent in London, we shouldn't be in business. It's as simple as that. We move on. I need to give you a flavour. I'm still on this background about the business. A flavour of what are these properties like? What are the customers like? And this slide is just showing you a publication that we did some time ago called Changing Environments. It's a book here. And this just goes to the fascinating history of our buildings. So we have things like the former Marmite factory. We have on the top over there, that's a chocolate factory. That's its liquid all sorts. Separately, we have at Tower Bridge, we have the largest biscuit factory in the UK. That's where Garibaldi biscuits came from. Custard creams, all this kind of thing. We have here, down the, what about the Sanderson's wallpaper factory. So that's the kind of, a lot of our buildings are like that. And this just gives you a flavour of some of them. One thing about these buildings, there are now more jobs in these buildings than there ever were when they were in manufacturing. Many more jobs. Let's look at the customers. What are these customers like? We've got a separate book here called Dynamic Environments, which actually gives a flavour of some of our customers. And you've got some on the slide there. Some are kind of charitable groups, the London Cycling Campaign up there. This is Construction Resources in the middle at the bottom. They're an ethically based building resource group. On the left, you've got somebody from the Prince's Trust. It's a whole range of different type of customers. And here you've got some more pictures of them. One problem we have with the pictures is that a lot of our customers, we can't just take attractive photos of. You know, so if you're in design, some sets, it's very hard. What we're just here to give you some interesting ones. The guy in the bottom left-hand corner, by the way, he does, it's filming and sets and things like that. This is all acoustic, kind of the sign maker. Lovely design studios, top left. This lady's famous cameraman. So that's the kind of things that, kind of customers. What happens though? How do the customers and buildings interrelate though? Why assure this side? It's because it's about incubation. Incubation. It's about firms starting up and growing. So on the right here, you've got the ex-Sanderson's wallpaper factory. And from that building, you've had companies that are now on the stock exchange, Clinical Computing, Drew Scientific, other ones from there, people like Petplan, one of the travel groups that you know about. The one on the left, Palma Deposit, is an interesting one. I put QXL there. QXL, the internet company, internet auction company, which I think were rivaling eBay or whatever. But they started off in that building. They moved to another building. They then got a dollop of cash from the city and managed to buy a freehold elsewhere. And they took with them on the way through our office manager. Interesting one in the middle is Westgate Centre. And little more than garages there. And if any of you know Oasis, the band Oasis, Creation Records, they started there. Interestingly, in the Sunday Times yesterday, there was an article about a chap called Martin Dawes, who's created a company called Coffee Nation. Right? So now, this year, we'll have about a £10 million turnover. 4 years ago, he was in 200 or 300 square feet at Leroy House on the corner of Essex Road, junction between Hackney and Islington. So that's the kind of company we are on. Incubation. And this one is going to illustrate something else about our customers, that we have world leaders. Because when you start thinking about small businesses, you don't think of world leaders. In the middle one, we've got a leather market. We've got a company called Exis Technologies. It's only four or five guys. But they actually have computer programs that actually monitor the containers on ships and where you should put those containers. And there's all these rules about where you should put the containers, because if you put them the wrong way, you actually the whole ship blows up and that. And they're a market leader in that business. Westminster Business Square. Has anybody been to Dubai? Anybody been to Dubai? What is that? Oh, right, we've got one. Paul Chester, what's you? Well, the major hotel in Dubai now is the Burj Al Arab Hotel, the really posh one, you know, seven star, whatever it is, and it's but in fact, all the internal of that were done by a company called OCK Creative. They're a customer at Westminster Business Square on the left. And finally, this picture on the right, Fairchild Training Estate. What I'm trying to show there is actually this is a colleague of a guy called David Mackie. David Mackie's a famous sculptor. He's now left, actually, as to buy freehold premises, but it's in the creative sector. This is actually created out of coat hangers. So that's the kind of thing customers we have. Well, this final slide is showing you just a pie chart about the spread of our customer base. And really, the key things I think I'd say about this is that when you classify our customers and you use the DTI classifications, industry, all that, totally inappropriate for small businesses. The small businesses will do everything there. So, but having said that, you use these classifications and you come out with this. And as you can see, the majority of our customers are in the creatives or the service sectors. But what about this bit of about 15% manufacturing? Well, actually, that includes, in the definitions, food processing. So we have a lovely estate at Acton at Park Royal, which has got a Lebanese bakery, South Korean, Thai, a whole lot of food companies servicing the West End. In fact, they're classified as manufacturing. So that just to give you a flavour. What I say about this slide, though, is what this is saying. This is actually a slide about London as a global city. Because when we talk about London as a global city, we talk about the dominance of finance and business services and things like that. What makes London different is the whole spread of small businesses that are servicing London and everything. That's what you need to take away from it. So, I think that covers the flavour of our business. And I hope people have got an idea of the business. You actually never appreciate our business unless you come on site, unless you visit and see the customers, you see the energy, dynamism, the variety of what goes on. And it's certainly something we as a business have had difficulties with investors and that over time, because they say, well, what are these small businesses like? But the only way is actually to go out and have a look at them. So the slides are helpful, but you really need to see it. Now, what I'm going to go through now, for the final part of the talk, is just what are the factors underpinning our business? How do I see some of the factors that contribute to our success? And what I'm going to do is take you through these here. And I'm going to focus more on customers, because customers is the most important of the lot. I'm going to use some statistics from various things, but I just emphasise the way I use statistics, I'm drawing on robust assumptions, conclusions for our business. Let's talk about the customers. First of all, what do we mean by SMEs in the UK? And the top slide there, you show 99% of the 3.95 million businesses in the UK are small. In fact, most have no employees. 70% have no employees. But as you go through the figures of the makeup of the population of UK businesses, you find you can go to the bottom one, 93% of London's businesses are between 1 and 24 employees. What I'm trying to draw out here is that the rest of the property sector focuses on the other 7%. We focus on this huge marketplace. We let everybody else focus on these tenants of good covenant, larger employees, you know, people like Enron, Arthur Andersen, good covenants. So we have this huge marketplace. What else, though, in this huge marketplace? And the key thing about this huge marketplace is I want to talk, I'll talk again here, it's about churn. But this slide is showing you starts and closures for last year. And in fact, starts were greater than closures last year. And in fact, the stock of UK businesses, though, through the 1990s was pretty static, actually. But over the last 18 months, it has grown because starts have exceeded closures. But the key thing I want to give you from this is overall stability. What you have is about 300,000 to 400,000 starts a year and 300,000 to 400,000 exits. And you have this kind of churn within the whole business structure. And churn's important. But overall, it's quite a stable stock. And even if you look at the early 1990s, or the recession that we had, the UK stock of businesses only declined by a couple hundred thousand. Yeah, there was a lot more churn, but the total stock was pretty stable. What happens, though, with these closures? And this slide I'm trying to show here, the low percentage of closures that ever occur because of liquidations and bankruptcies. Yet when you read the press, whenever it comes out, there's been so many closures this year, everybody thinks closures means failure, means financial failure. Wrong. A maximum, absolute maximum of 1 in 5 small business closures is a financial failure. I reckon it's more like 1 in 10 or whatever, but who cares? It's of that order. It's a small proportion. Yet when you read something about the sector, you hit it and say, oh, these closures, exits, financial failures. No. About language and everything. This is an interesting study done by people over at Kingston University. We work closely with Rob Blackburn and David Stokes at Kingston. Well, they did a study some time ago monitoring exits and looking at what happens to a number of exits. You know, total. And this is the first one. They said, well, what happens to the businesses, first of all? And there you see it, over 50% of the businesses survive the exit of the owner. So they carry on, they reopen, they're sold on. Only there on this graph, 1 in 5 are insolvent. The closed down ones are closed down for a variety of different reasons. You know, I'm 60 odd, I want to have another life. I end it, you know. Other reasons, but not about insolvency, not about financial failure. And what the study says, though, is that, well, that's quite interesting, isn't it? What happens to the business? Well, what happens to the owners? What happens to the other side of it? Because that's the other part of this. Of course, what this says, the majority of the owners, nearly two-thirds of the owners, carry on in some respect as a stay in self-employment, start a new enterprise, or whatever. Only, as you see, 30% seek employment. And the majority of them as well see it all as a positive learning experience. Well, that's actually crucial with small business, about this whole idea of serial entrepreneurship, which I'm coming on to. The interesting thing about their study, by the way, it's over quite a restricted time period. And what I get interested in about this is, what would happen if you did this over a long period of time? And how far would people keep coming backwards and forwards? And who are the serial entrepreneurs? Who are the portfolio entrepreneurs? And whatever. It's quite interesting stuff, this. Now, where I get to with all this is that churn. And churn is good. In the property sector, churn is bad. You lose your customers. Churn, though, is good. It actually, for us as a business, it means you can actually improve rents and things like that. But actually, churn is hellishly complicated. It really is. So, by location, I don't know whether you read some of these inner city studies. Inner city studies, when they look at small businesses, certainly in the London context, Hackney, whatever, everybody gets scared when they find that 1 in 4 of the small businesses are thinking of moving. They think, what is happening? And actually, if you're a small entrepreneur, moving ahead, trying to do something, you're always going to be thinking of doing something, moving, going bigger, smaller, changing. The enterprise culture is about that. But people interpret it as being locationally driven. How do you get the locational factor out of the other ones? So I believe at this moment, of the SMEs we look at, which are micro businesses, yes, so particularly those with less than 10 employees, one in five thinking of moving. So in the context of the figures I've given you earlier, that's about 80,000 small businesses. That doesn't mean, by the way, when I say that, they're all going to move, ever. I'm just talking about the thinking, and entrepreneurs will think about it. How do you do it by enterprises? There's this whole work that you can see about small businesses, that the survival rates of small businesses over the 1990s has improved. So the proclivity of enterprises to last 5 years has been increasing. Not so much as in London, actually, in recent years, but it's all tied in this with churn. The other thing about this serial entrepreneurs is who are the serial entrepreneurs? Who are these people who set up one business, then go on and set up another and control them? Who are they? And what work has been done on them? Another thing about churn, the Chancellor said, a couple of years ago, would say, we want to create another 100,000 new businesses. And just by implication, what is being said there is that there'll be an increase in the number of exits. Because it's about churn. So our customers, the kind of customers we look at, are second stage customers. They've actually worked at home. They've probably been in existence a few years. They've moved into premises. They're going to be more stable. We don't work about the average time that a customer stays with us. And say, on that work, we'd say they stay with us at least 4 to 6 years. But actually, it's misleading that, because that's actually a company, say, called Harry Platt Incorporated. And what that ignores is the fact that after 4 years, I've joined with Paul Cheshire, and I'm doing pretty well, giving him a bit of the equity, and we've now got this new company called Harry Platt and Paul Cheshire. So I've had a change of name. So what I'm just saying is, 4 to 6 years, but with one name. When you monitor changes in that, the same actors, what is the resilience? So when I get to on this, I'm trying to say that in this sector that everybody thinks is churn is that's risk and things like that. In fact, what we're dealing with is a highly stable overall sector. We're dealing with a lot of customer resilience, especially, and if you put in expert management the way we have, you can actually get a firm, resilient income stream. We run a hotel for small businesses that focuses on that. We've done some recent work on this with Kingston, and it's on our website, and one of my colleagues, Matthew James, has done this with David Stokes. And basically, what's done here is to look at, it was about 240 of our customers, it was about 10% out of the survey at that time, and we benchmarked a lot of the questions against these surveys, so to get some comparators. And it was done earlier this year, so the survey was about February. And I'm only giving you a flavour of this. If you want to go on the website, you can find out other things about it. But one area that was looked at was about performance. How do people see their performance? Both, and how did they perform in the past, now, and in the future? Well, this just is showing a slide that at that time, people were thinking it's pretty good, actually. The majority across all sectors are in good financial health. The interesting thing that I got from this is that Matthew did an exercise of comparing this with how entrepreneurs saw themselves. And he did a series of questions which were benchmarked against the Kingsley, a separate survey. So, and the kind of questions he was asking was, to a business, was, do you see yourself as a traditional business person or a 20th century entrepreneur? Do you regard yourself as a risk taker or you prefer to avoid risk? So there's a whole series of questions there. And what actually you find from that is that the more risk taking the 21st century entrepreneurs would actually be more at that end and that end. The more traditional enterprises will be more in the middle. That's quite interesting. So that's about performance. This for our business, this is fundamental. So the median turnover in this survey, the median turnover of customers was about 250,000. And rent was 5% of turnover. When I said about the affordability of our rents in London, that's what we're talking about. If you're a knowledge-based or a creative and cultural business in London, you don't have a high asset spending or whatever, but to employ one additional member of staff costs you twice as much as the rent. That shows the potential for growth as we go forward. This is a slide just on profitability, which showed on those particular customers, they're doing pretty well. And this is an interesting one, innovation. So the London Employers Survey did some questions about the introduction of new processes or new products into a variety of different businesses. And the innovators are those who both, in the last 12 months, introduced a new product and a new process, if you like. Those are the innovators. What you find from this is that twice as many of our customers, twice as many of them had introduced both in comparison to the London survey. And what we're getting at here is that our customers who we target, high value added, creative, cultural, knowledge-based industries, are actually the more successful ones. So what we build up from that is the archetype, if you like, of our entrepreneurs and our the business customers. So the age, if you look at that, what's the typical workspace entrepreneur in comparison to the general market? Well, they tend to be younger, more educated, more of them are university educated. Motivational factors, more of the, rather than the push factors, it's pull factors that bring them in. Business styles tend to be more of, as I said, the entrepreneur, the risk-taker side. More successful. Interestingly, serial and portfolio managers. One in three of our customers in this survey were serial entrepreneurs. They'd had a business before. One in five had another business. So that's the portfolio side. If you look at the other side of it, what about the businesses themselves? Well, more of them were incorporated in terms of the legal type. They had higher turnover than the general average in the other surveys. 75% have been in existence for over 5 years. And I've just said they're more innovative. So what I'm just painting a picture of here is that we, long-term, target the growth sectors of London in small businesses. Now, that's a lot of talking about the customers. I'll just give you a few minutes now on other factors, but two slides on the buildings. What about the buildings though, that you've got? And let's look at some issues around the underlying value of the buildings. And what I mean by that is if we're dealing with very low capital values. So we had a fire in one of our buildings a number of years ago. This is at Ferry Lane in Raynham. Ferry Lane is in our books at 850,000 at that time. The fire completely gutted the whole place. The insurance settlement to rebuild the premises was 1.5 million. We then sold the land for 550,000. To which, of course, analysts would say, hang on, mate, should burn some more down if that's the case. But actually, the fundamental value is there. It's about low capital values focused on our sector. It's not obsolescent stock. And what's interesting, I think, from the real estate sector is how you actually measure obsolescence in buildings. Ours tend to be older buildings, obsolescence has gone through on that, but how do you look at obsolescence and you factor that in? These are tremendously adaptable buildings. They can be used for a variety of purposes. A key issue has been, over the last 2 or 3 years, providing broadband infrastructure, which we've done in terms of the 1.7 million square feet of stock that's actually closer into the centre. What about the stock? You can actually, because of its locations and that, you've got this potential intensification of the stock or the change of use. If you look at historically, we've sold some of our estates, one for hotel development, some have gone for residential. We even actually facilitated the Arsenal football ground. So our buildings are in strategic locations long term. Finally, the last point I put interesting, but that is actually fundamental. To appeal to our customer group, young entrepreneurs in those particular sectors, they don't want dry, insipid buildings. They want something that's character that they can get to grips with. And that's what we provide. And this is just a slide showing some of the kind of things I'm on about here. The top left-hand corner is just one of our shed schemes. So we do have these industrial sheds, but actually when you look at them and the locations, you can go high. You know, there's all this earth space bit above them and changes you can do. On the right, you can see this is Wharf Road. The central is a central slide there just showing it as it is at the moment. The right-hand side is showing the planning application that we have in for a mixed-use residential workspace scheme. This is just simply on the bottom right-hand corner. It's just simply the improvements in one of our buildings at Barley Mill, the foyer. The bottom left-hand corner is just the new roof and that at the Leather Market, which is a listed buildings complex. The middle building at the bottom, though, is fascinating. So the middle building, that's West Point Studios. And if you ever get a chance to go and visit that, this is built underneath the Westway. The Westway runs on the top of it and is the hall around which we've got all these creative and cultural industries in two kind of podiums on either side. And it's a hive of activity. It's in so-called regeneration area of London. So those are the kind of things about our buildings. Let's move on on something else. The buildings actually whilst they're interesting on their own, actually, it's how they work with other buildings. And it's how these clusters work. And I'll just give you two slides here about clusters. And this is the cluster on the south bank, so you've got the city across the river there. And these buildings that you've got down here that are shown, number one, you know, we bought them over a period of time. Number seven was at the leather market, was the first one we've acquired. The most recent acquisition on this one would be number two, South Bank House. The actual slide doesn't show you one that's further into Bermondsey, which is this former biscuit factory that we have. And what we do here is we create communities. We create communities within the buildings. Because in each of these buildings, you've got, say, 60 or 80 customers. And so we have newsletters, and you want them to start feeding off each other. We want tenants directory and things like that. But actually, if you look at this, there's also a slide about rental progression. So some of our customers will move from number 7 across to number 4, higher rent. So leather market, say, rents are £15 to £20. For number 4, you're getting on to £25 to £30 a square foot. So that's the kind of scale, how clusters work together. The most interesting cluster I like is this other one, though, that's north of Notting Hill, if you like, Ladbroke Grove. That's 4, 5, and 6. Number 9 is Westbourne Studios, the one I've just shown you. What's interesting about that cluster, which is really, really tight, is that everything that we provide there is affordable, flexible space for new and small businesses, but there's a range of sizes. So in one building, the size is maybe more of 250, 500 square feet. Another building, say, 1,500 square feet. There's a mixture of styles, so some will be cheaper than others. Also, some of our customers will use the buildings in different ways. So Westbourne Studios, quite interesting, we have some music businesses there, but who actually use Canalot Studios, only, you know, less than a mile away, for the recording studios. So the back off office and the front office. So it's all about how clusters work. An interesting challenge for us as a business, what we're trying to create is, of course, we create within our buildings clusters, in other words, a community, how businesses can be encouraged to work together. With this kind of work, we're trying to create clusters and how a series of buildings work together. But longer term, of course, what we're trying to create is a community of our businesses across London. We're trying to get to, there's 3,000, we have 3,800 customers, which we all want them to go away, if they leave us, to recommend us. They've got, those businesses have probably 35,000 people that they employ. We want all of those people to be recommending workspace. So that's the issue of clusters. Yeah, but what about our positioning in London? So we are the major supplier of this space in London, by far. But how does that picture for the future? And I think you'll all be aware of what really the key ingredients of the London plan. But if we just go through these, London is a global city, I've said, along with New York, Tokyo. And the foundations of that global city is not just finance and business services, it's this whole range of small businesses which make up London's diversity, creativity, and that. The London plan says the population is going to grow dramatically by the size of Leeds. Ken Livingstone would say by 2016. Extra jobs, net extra jobs of 600,000. Gross about 800,000. Half of those 800,000 new jobs are in finance and business services. The rest are actually in these whole sectors that we are dealing with. Even if these figures are wrong, whatever is happening, there's massive growth coming through in London. And interestingly, you talk about this regeneration. Where's that growth going to occur? Of course, people focus on the key diagram in the London plan, which is fine. And you can see the growth corridors of Thames Gateway to the east, also the Lee Valley corridor, Western Wedge, supposedly, and that. But really, when you look at a slide like this, you tend to focus on the centre and the big red blob. I focus on this slide, though, which is the slide about the areas of intensification and the opportunity areas in London. And it shows you it's these areas where, under the London plan, people are talking about high-intensity development. Because the basic features of the plan are saying is that we need more housing, we need more a whole range of support services within London, and where is that going to be focused? And in fact, when you go through this, those are the areas in which we have buildings or we focus our buildings. Those are the areas in which we acquire. In fact, we've done an exercise in our stock at the moment. So of our total portfolio, we reckon that 45% will be subject to change of use or intensification within over a 10-year period. We've never bought it for that purpose. We buy it for existing use. And today, we only buy for existing use. But inevitably, in the nature of the city, and that can change, that will occur. So that's about intensification. And that is a bit about, I suppose, the traditional property stuff, that kind. The other thing about London as a global city is, of course, it's becoming younger. The population is becoming younger. And the population increase is fueled by net immigration. And I would argue that net immigration is good for small business formation. The type of migrants that are moving are those who are more likely to be entrepreneurial, dynamic, risk-taking, and that again is good for us, London as a whole. I think you can also say that there's work being done by the London School of Economics, by London Business School, which is on about the comparison of entrepreneurial rates in different countries. And our proclivity in the UK to establish new businesses is behind that of the States, but ahead of that of Europe. And of course, it's still increasing. So we're tied in with the entrepreneurial society. And the final one is about the growth of creative and cultural industries, which are high skill and high value added. And I've got a slide here, which really is from Creative London, and about the importance of that sector to London over the last few years. And as I said earlier, these kind of customers in music, performing arts, design of fashion and that, they don't want just only office blocks and this kind of thing. What they want is funky, creative space that they can do something with and work with like-minded businesses. That's the kind of product that we supply. And finally, the factors that I go through is just about time. Our business has grown, 1987 was set up. Last time we raised equity was in 1994. It's grown steadily and organically over a long period of time. We monitor our targets for, as I said, 10 years. We've now got this leading position within London, and yet such a small market share that we have of the total marketplace. And we can double in size and still be pretty small, scratching the surface. But the final factor is pretty important for long-term of our business. We're trying to create a long-term, highly profitable, sustainable business. And the importance of so-called CSR issues and social responsibility issues are fundamental to our business. A lot of our customers are in, and younger customers than that, are in sectors that they actually want to work with a landlord with certain values. And actually, we've got a lot to learn from our customers as we go forward. And that's fundamental. So, just some concluding remarks. This site just shows our positioning, what we're trying to be in terms of our new customers. We want to be perceived as being the kind of landlord that people would want to go to because you're joining a group of successful, innovative enterprises. And we want our existing customers to recognise again that they're part of that community. But the more important ones, I suppose, the targets as we go forward as the other two. To our investors, they're saying, well, we're looking for high levels of return. And with our investors recognising the kind of target groups that we're aiming at, they can look at this and say, well, actually, if you get a 50p increase in rent, what does it mean in terms of value? And I'm sure a lot of you can go away and work that out, the gearing effects. But 50p for our customers, 50p on rent per square foot, is very, very little in terms of the turnover and everything. So you can see the long-term potential there for an investor, what we're talking about. And the final one, this is an area with gatekeepers and local authorities, is one that we're only just building up because this has to be built up over time when we have this portfolio. We say in about 4 years' time we'll have £1 billion portfolio in London, again, organically grown. But we will be perceived as being the kind of enterprise that can create successful incubator schemes in so-called deprived areas of London. And actually this is about targeting local authorities and so-called gatekeepers. So that's workspace. I hope I've covered the kind of things I said at the top there, at the beginning, that our tenants are customers, that we're dealing with this great big spread of small businesses, that our properties are prime, they are prime for our sector, that just because we have short-term leases doesn't mean it's risky or not. In fact, it's a more resilient and growing income stream than if you had just a number of AAA covenants and paying you a lot of money each one because something could happen to them. It's all about long-term positioning, as I said there. I'd say that just the importance with our business about the management, I think, is crucial. And the business long-term depends upon having a superb team of people working within the company. And that goes for everybody, for out of the 150 of us that are involved. And it's also about the standards of service, customer service, that the whole of the team is providing, because that's the long-term basis for us. And finally, I'd just like to leave you with a thought about how do you value this as an investor? How do you want to value it? I haven't touched that anyway. You could actually look at it as just the income stream. So we've got a 40 million income stream. which I would argue every time we buy more and more properties, you get more and more customers, and you're spreading the resilience of the income stream. You could just actually value it on the income stream based against guilds. You could actually value it based on the individual properties that I've just said about the fundamental value behind them. You could look at the portfolio and how this is working together. You could look at this whole thing about the change of use, which is not factored into existing valuations. But I prefer, if I have a preference, I prefer to say that if you're investing in workspace, you're investing in the long-term future of London, and you've got to believe in that the long-term growth of London, and that you believe that the small businesses are a crucial part of that, and that we're providing the infrastructure for them, and that. My job's not actually to focus on the valuation, because that's you as investors or elsewhere. Our job is just to produce this long-term business focused on our sector. So Howard, thank you.
Thanks so much. First question to ask is, when are you having a rights issue that we can participate in?
Okay, right. And the answer to that is we will not be having a rights issue because this company has grown organically since 1994. It's focused on high equity returns and has been consistently. And we're driving continuous high equity returns. That's not to say if ever a certain opportunity came up, something might happen, but you know, never rule anything out. But long-term, we're about high equity returns.
Okay. So that was just a personal question.
I
have my checkbook here, in case there was an offer. We will take questions from either London or Wisconsin. And indeed, although Wisconsin has suddenly frozen, now there you are, you've come alive again. Any questions from Madison who'd like to kick off? Okay, well, we'll leave you to ponder that. So we'll look to the hall here. Yes, question over there.
Do you guys have questions?
So I'm not sure if Madison can hear the questions. Can you hear the questions?
No, we can't.
Okay.
But we can hear you very well.
The question really was, how far is the business vulnerable to volatility in the macroeconomy, if you like? I mean, would this business actually decline if the whole macroeconomy falls?
Okay. I think what I was trying to present is that this is a resilient sector. And we've had this question applied to us by investors since the birth of the company. And what I used to say is that when you have a recession, I got loads of customers because people are downsizing and people want to create businesses by the push factors. And the little dip that's occurred in the economy in the last 2.5 years, some investors have said, actually, workspace's occupancy, is it going to go down dramatically? And if you look at the record, our occupancy over the last, it dipped by about 1.5% to 2.5% maximum. If you follow it further, your question is about resilience. All right, what's the lowest occupancy in workspace ever had? So we work today at 90%. Right? The lowest occupancy we ever had was about a month after I arrived. It was about 75%. That was a portfolio that was based on the East End. It was a very different portfolio than we have today. And it was before we had the kind of hotel functions, the way we run it. Okay, today. We as a team would be disappointed if the occupancy ever went to the low 80%, even if we had a recession of the scale of the 90 to 91. Like, yeah. The other way of looking at it, what's your break-even occupancy? Our break-even occupancy, and which we pay dividends, is 60%. Now, if we're ever at 60% occupancy, UK PLC is bust. It is dire, right? You don't have to be an economist to work with it. It is dire. So that's my question about resilience.
I mean, it is, of course, quite difficult for any business to answer this question at the moment in the UK because we've had 48 consecutive quarters of growth, unlike any other major Western economy. Only China is in this kind of category. So it is a little bit difficult for people to answer this in a practical way, but that's a pretty persuasive answer, at least theoretically. Yeah.
Yeah.
question is whether Harry plans to take this model up to the north of England, because the questioner had spotted that he's not from London.
If I can just interrupt briefly to tell you that if we let you listen to us, we can't hear you. So we'll just not ask any question. We'll leave our mute on, because that way we can hear you very well. Okay?
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm from Oldham, right, but worked in London before Workspace as well. We actually, when we did our rights issue in 94, it was to buy a portfolio of estates in the Midlands. And we sold that portfolio after we built up that business for about 40 odd million in 1999. And that was quite deliberate. We did that because we then reached a scale in London that people were starting to recognise us. And we said, look, we're going to take this equity now and reinvest it in London, because the prospects for growth are far greater than buying stock in the Midlands and elsewhere. So it's a very focused strategy, right? Now, would we go elsewhere? Well, that's not immediately, because there's a huge marketplace in London. We can double in size in London and still be scratching the surface. So why spread our management? Why spread our equity in that way? So it's actually quite focused. Could you actually create a business elsewhere like this? The model can work elsewhere, but actually, the high value-added businesses that we target, the churn that occurs in London, the startup rates that occur in London, are far greater than any other regional cities. So the growth is there. Yeah.
Yes.
Which was your first?
No. Ballymore was developed by John Townsend and David Rock. And Ballymore, we've acquired some of the original Workspace schemes. So in the 1980s and 1970s, some of these were created. So that's Ballymore. Ballymore, by the way, just from interest, there's a floor in Ballymore that's there, kind of half this building, right? And you have about 20 enterprises in it, and they're separated by partitions that high. And so if they want a bit more space, we push the partition up, yeah? And we have to charge them for that. And they're actually businesses that relate to each other, things like that. And in the 80s, when this was created by David Rock and John Townsend, it's really at the high end of what was happening in the architectural profession. So if you'd been an architect studying then, you'd have followed what they were doing. Similarly to what you'd have followed what other guys were doing at Clerkenwell Workshops and Dryden Street. So there's about four of them. We've just got two of them, there's two still long-term targets. But your question was, what was the first one? That there was a portfolio acquired from the residuary body of the GLC, which was a dozen or so estates, and then other schemes we built up over time, we've acquired. I suppose one of the flagship schemes would be the Leather Market Buildings, which we bought in 1993, which is 160,000 square feet, former Leather Market Buildings of London, 120,000 square feet net. It's now kind of 70 to 80, creative and cultural industries. It just lets itself. And how do we let it? How do people find out about it? Well, it's word of mouth. Yes, the signboard acts as there, but it's there. It's more word of mouth. Okay? And that was the first one.
David Rock is a great architect, but a terrible cricketer. Oh, I've played against him 10 times, and he's never won. Right, over there. Question is whether, since they buy secondary and tertiary stock, they often have to make renovations, and is that done in-house?
No, it's programmed in-house, but we use external builders and things like that. But there's two aspects to what you say about that. Yes, we buy, you said secondary and tertiary buildings, but remember I say they're prime for our stock, yeah? I said for our customers, they're prime. We will, when we buy a building, how do we take the income yield higher? Well, it's about management, filling the voids, and actually, you know, the appearance. It's about the colour, the feel of the building, so we will invest at that stage. Ongoing maintenance and that, you've got to keep these properties up to scratch, and that's the length, and they aren't quite, you know, maintenance intensive. That is financed all from the service charges. The customer pays for that. So that's how we try and track that. And maybe actually, when there'll be a need after 10 years on a particular building, you need a revamping of some of the communal areas and things like that. But long term, it's not major spend.
Can I give Wisconsin another chance? Anybody with a question from there? Yes. You have to switch your mute off, yeah. Are you coming through?
They're not audible.
Yeah, they have to switch their mute off, don't they?
I switched it on.
Okay.
And so for a little while, we just won't hear anything ourselves. But maybe I'll just actually ask a question myself then. You said at some point that you were a gatekeeper for the local authorities. It seems that in some of these buildings you are changing the use of the building. You're bringing a mix of tenants with all kinds of types of economic activities. I wonder to what extent a lot of your business is about getting the right planning permissions or having the right interaction with the regulators or local authorities so that you can put in tenants who can do what they want to do in there. And if I can, while we have the sound on, because I will have to shut it off after that if we want to hear anything, was wondering whether your mixed-use commercial and residential is in part the way for you to handle some of the pressure from your small businesses who are having difficulties getting employees to work with them and locate in London. Now shut off the sound and take advantage of this opportunity to thank you very much for this lecture.
The first question was whether part of your skill or part of your success depended on having very good relationships with local authorities, and particularly for getting rapid agreements to change of use, etc. Was that a key part of the business mix? Right. And the second one, I think, was about, I'm not quite sure I've totally followed it, but I think it was about the employment opportunities for people within your small businesses, because you were talking about your clusters and whether you got involved in that.
I think it's the residential, the mixed residential work space.
The first thing is the planning authorities like our type of use for buildings because obviously it's employment, small businesses, so that seems being attracted. Sometimes in the past, I think there's a real issue at times with planners about understanding what the nature of small businesses is than what we've got, because when you see them on site and how they interrelate, it's actually got a different feel than something that's quite arbitrary. So the planning authorities like our kind of use. If you look at it for a change of use or alternative uses on the buildings and residential, we don't get involved in any use that's not workspace. So if there's a site that we have, a scheme that we have, and such as say at Wharf Road that I showed you, that's the scheme that we're going in for planning in at the moment. It's 35,000 square feet of workspace. The planning application is for 35,000 square feet of workspace plus 35,000 square feet of residential. We'll get that consent because it fits in with the agenda for London. It's a mixed use scheme and that. We will then, someone else will take on the development and construction risk. They'll provide to us a cash sum and also the workspace back. And that's how we'll structure that. If you think about it on a longer term perspective, which is still on the same issue, you get time, and I'm a town planner initially, but this whole thing about live-work in London. So there's this whole idea that, you know, how far will people live and work in the same premises and that? And certainly in some parts of London, some developers the last 4 or 5 years, I've got live-work consent, but it's actually been a quasi-consent for residential. And then so Titan is turning against it and things like that. Now, that's quite interesting and that, but actually in the long term, if you look at it over years, the idea of live-work is where a lot of small businesses are going to go, because that's about mixed-use communities and that. And what will be interesting is how the planning regime and the tenancy regime actually accommodates that. And what will then be interesting, what I'm interested about, is really our buildings are well positioned really long term for any moves that way, because they're adaptable buildings. So that's, I hope that answers your question.
Another one, yes. Sorry. Thank you.
Right.
The question is whether traditionally conservative property investors are becoming more interested in this kind of proposition.
Okay. We've had some investors who've been with us for a long time. Right. Even there's some who were there in '87, saw it then, and done rather well. But actually, what we did a number of years ago, as we were trying to tell the story about this, we're in the real estate sector of the stock exchange and that. And there was a suggestion that we should move to support services, which we would strongly resist, because underpinning our assets is this real estate. But we did, a number of years ago, go around other investors from the so-called support services side, and it's actually an earnings focus, right? And to explain, because actually, they understood, we had real problems with some real estate analysts to understand what we were saying here. Now they've actually come round because they see the model working and they see the resilience of the income stream. But it's been quite a long-term picture. And some people would say that how we're valued now is this kind of, we're different in the real estate sector, there's the support services, and it's this mix, right? The underpinning of real estate, but we actually give, on the whole, double-digit earnings growth year on year, which, of course, real estate companies don't do. So it's been a long, but we have now, I think, a series of long-term supporters, or I have had, who've had good returns. They'll always stick around with us while we're providing those returns. And they'll take a judge on what we provide to investors is a clear plan going forward. So the plan at the moment that we say is that a year ago today, in fact, we updated our business plan going forward. And we showed that on just some simple assumptions, the value of the portfolio would increase from 500 million to 1 billion within 5 years. And those simple assumptions were buy 50 million to 60 million pounds of the property a year, which we do easily. Two, rental growth of 5% per annum. But that's not rental growth of market rents. In fact, there's a difference between 90% of our ERV market rents today and our current rents is about 11 or 12 million. So it's actually just saying husband the stock as it is. It's predicated on no yield shift. It's predicated on no change of use, right? Which are other elements. And actually, if you do the figures through, based on the financial model, it works.
Thanks, Green Man.
Sort of in line with the previous question, actually. In terms of investors, would you consider yourself, say, a good diversifier to a portfolio of property companies and a portfolio, say, a general stock portfolio? Do you have any figures? What's your correlation to the FTSE 100 and to the FTSE real estate, things like that?
The question is really how far this is a diversifying investment for people who otherwise are holding a portfolio of property investments, or indeed in relation to the stock market index as a whole.
We've outperformed the indices you mentioned considerably. You can see that from the figures. If you look at annual report accounts, you can see that. I mean, I'm not an investor, like you said, but I mean, what I was trying to say in my talk is that an investment is us is an investment in the long-term future of London, if you like. An investment in us is about the small firm sector. An investment in us is if you look at the real estate. You can look at us in many different ways. And I think
but that's your price performance. I think what you're after really is the extent to which your price performance mirrors the property sector or has indeed moved in a different way. So it's potentially a diversification opportunity.
Our price performance has been higher than the property sector. So.
But not moving differently. Moving up faster, but not, as it were, counter-cyclical.
If you look at the IPD performance chart, okay, which was about this resilience, yeah, our fundamental business and its share price performance is less volatile. Is very much less volatile. Again, and as we grow, it becomes more and more less volatile. That's what I was trying to say. It's the exact opposite of what you would think from dealing with small businesses. And that is actually what the business is about.
A couple more white shirts. Question is how lending banks are affected by the 3-month break clause in the typical lease.
Well, it's quite. We had issues with the banks in 1991-92, and so there's one major bank, and we flipped between two different areas, two banks, and it was about perceptions. But then, in about when we floated in 93. And the equity market still hadn't realised our value and things like that. Some debt providers could recognise the resilience argument about the spread. So when we now have the debt provided by about 150 million by NatWest Bank and over 200 million by Bradford and Bingley, and we've grown those with us since 1993. And they recognised the resilience of this income stream. So when you go to them with just one property, 10 customers say, all of whom could leave in 3 months. Mark, what kind of proposition is that? Go to them with 50 properties, with 1,500 customers, who could all leave in 3 months, talk a different proposition when you've got this bad management regime. When you then show them that the bad debt record is never greater than 0.25% of turnover, because a customer, when they come in, they've got to pay you something up front. I hopefully 3 months rent and 3 months deposit, but for you, 2 months deposit and 1 month rent, whatever. It's positive. So, and what we have today is that I'd argue that the debt markets in the mid-1990s understood as before the equity markets. And you can follow this actually through, because our share price performance started then to come through to the NAV. So we're now at a premium to NAV, as we stand today, but that's because the equity markets have come through over the last 4 years. But the debt markets understood it early. And we have no problem with debt. Absolutely no problem.
You've had one go, so I'm going to pick on. I'll come back to you, but I'll. Yeah.
Hi.
Question really is about long-term risk management strategy.
The long-term risks are about around the SME sector, right? The 3 months break, which our customers have, that's an opportunity for them to grow as well as decline in size within our stock. It's fundamental to the marketing, right? It's not a risk, it's actually an opportunity. And I tried to show in one of the slides there, the average customer stays with us 4 to 6 years. But actually, that's low. It's actually much longer than that. Now, if you were a traditional property company, and you put somebody on a 10-year lease, 5-year break or whatever, and you think that that's better than what I've got, it isn't. And you've got the risks that surround that as well. Ours, because of the churn and the management of this, the whole is far, far greater than individual ones. And as we grow, when we get 5,000 customers, the resilience of our income stream is far greater than it is today. So which would you rather have? 3,800 customers giving you 40 million a year, or 8 customers each giving you 5 million a year, and all those 8 being AAA covenants? And as I said earlier, one of them's Enron. Which one do you want? Every time, on risk management, you focus on ours. Sorry?
Yeah. The question is on how frequent rent reviews are.
Right, the rent reviews come in at every 3 years, yeah? So it's a 3-year lease, protected by the Landlord Tenant Act, 3 months right to break. In global terms, going back to this, first of all, we have 25% churn in our stock a year, of which half is internal, yeah? So, with that and the 3-year review, so you say a third of our stock is reviewed every 3 years, yeah? 40% of our rents are reviewed every year. Okay? Now, how do we review them? It's then about, I put a slide there, nobody's asked me this, it's about what do you mean by marginal and average rents? Nobody's asked that, but anyway. Now, it will depend upon the climate. Now, if you've been with us a long time, right, as a customer, your colleague next to you has just joined us, and you've come in as a new customer and you're paying us £15 a square foot. You've been with us 3 years, right? You're paying £9 a square foot. So we're going to do the review, yeah? Now, forget about all this Section 25 notes. It's all this paraphernalia, this feudal system that we have about rent reviews, right? We'll have a talk. So he's paying 15, that's the market rate, right? You've been with us 3 years, nice face, we'll do a deal at 13.50. How are you? Are you happy? Yeah, right, good. So we do it, cut the documentation. I've now got £1.50 reversionary value on tap in the future. I've got a satisfied customer with you, yeah? And I've actually opted on the rent. Why do I need churn? Because I need the new tenants coming in. Where do I get churn from? I get it from the entrepreneurs, because they're always moving around. So we don't, it's not about RPIs and that. So in this climate, over the last year, what have we been doing on rent reviews the last year? Well, we haven't been doing rent reviews, have we? Because although our particular sector is totally different than the city, we know over the last 18 months there's been problems in the city, rent, and that affects perceptions. You'd be, so we hold things back. So in this climate, we haven't been actually reviewing over the last year. And what we said to the markets is, the name of the game is to make sure the occupancy is at resilient 90%. So if you look at our figures, we're now at resilient 90%. And we'll carry on with that for another quarter or so. And once we've got that resilience, then we'll actually come in with the rent reviews. And they're stocked up, right? And we'll give you a good deal. As you've been with us for 3 years, you'll be happy. And I'm focusing there on average rents. Now, traditional valuers, you know, down the city and everywhere, they're going to focus on, I want the highest rent possible. You know, 15, stuff like that. We're not in that game at all. Because we're into long-term husbanding of our stock. That's how we do rent.
The question is whether there's a place in this portfolio for a large company taking a lot of space, and there was one called QXL which led the portfolio.
Okay, well, but right, two parts to this. Right, in my book, Changing Environments, Mr. Mehmet in there. Mr. Mehmet runs a company that is a distributor of textiles, sources the textiles in Eastern Europe, services Next and various people. He joined us in 1991 in one little unit in Bow. He then got into a third of the estate. Bow Estate is 60,000 square feet. And all these units had 20,000 square feet. We had to get him out. Why did we have to get him out? Because the average unit price is declining as somebody grows. We want to let it to small businesses. He wanted to stick with us. We couldn't get him to go. In the end, we bought a building in Barking. We constructed it with somebody. He's now a tenant there paying us £330,000 a year. Well, you know, throws these figures out, doesn't he? He's got an option to buy. The income yield on that is 10.5% today, which isn't bad. He's a happy bunny, we've got him out. But the issue actually is that when somebody grows on our estates, there comes a point that they have to move out. Because that's good for us, and it's good for them. And we're happy to see them go. And the message we want them to do, when they leave us, we want them simply to be going away and saying, well, actually, workspace ain't too bad, and I'd recommend them as a landlord. Why we want that is because we want all these customers who leave us, and all the inquiries to be recommending us as a long-term, you know, landlord. And if we create that, that's good.
Time is marching on. We can take a couple more. Do we have anybody else from Madison? Okay, we'll stick with, we're doing well here. I think I'll take a couple more. One there, and then you will be patient, yeah? Take this one first. The question is whether the estate is mainly freehold and whether they would consider taking a head lease and just chopping it up.
Yeah. So that is, yes, it's nearly all freehold. Yeah, some 999 year lease, but it's all freehold. And no, we would not consider taking a lease and splitting it up. Our model is based around generating real value, and obviously we want that to flow through to the asset value. So if you looked at the model in comparison, say, people know Regis? Well, Regis, the one similarity with Regis, which we would expose, true, it's about flexible leasing. That's totally. But everything else about the model is totally different. So we own our buildings, they don't. They deal with corporates, we deal with small businesses. They have most of their income coming in from 90 or so customers. We've got from 3,800. They provide a lot of services. Whilst we provide services on some part, it's actually quite modest. It's about the key things that matter. So we don't go in for just leasing something so somebody else can get that extra value coming forward. And given the financial capacity of the business going forward, we've got capacity today to buy, today we could buy £65 million of property, but we're gearing on that, it could be £200 million of the property. So we don't need to go into that kind of area.
Last one.
The question was on these working, what are your views on these working?
What are his views on live work units, which we discussed?
I tried to say, I think long term, there is a future for so-called live-work units. I really think over a 5 to 10 year horizon, people will be looking at that area, because it's got to be formalised in planning terms and also in the leasehold terms. Something's got to be sorted out there. I think some of the stuff that's happened has probably given it a bad name, but actually there's a lot of scope. In fact, an entrepreneur I mentioned earlier, of our 3,800 customers, I'd bet 50 or so sometimes sleep on the floors, wouldn't you? Entrepreneurs trying to do things, most definitely. So do it totally legally, like that, but they'll do it because they're trying to make things happen. And some very successful people that I know, who I've mentioned today, that's what they did.
There's quite a lot of people here who sleep on the floors, but during the day, difference really. I think we ought to wind up there, because for those in Madison, it's now 10 to 8 in the evening. Thank you very much, Harry, for a fascinating presentation. And as you could see here, it generated a huge amount of interest. If there's an immediate buying spurt in your shares in the morning, you'll know why. So we're very grateful to you for being here to do the second in our series of three lectures this term. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.